It's the Kim Munson Show, analyzing the most important stories.
That seems to me like government is establishing a religion.
The latest in politics and world affairs.
If you give people rights, women's rights, gay rights, whatever, there can't be equal rights if there are special rights.
Today's current opinions and ideas.
Surveys show that people still really prefer freedom over government force.
Is it freedom or is it force? Let's have a conversation.
Indeed, and welcome to the Kim Munson Show. I'm Kim Munson, and thank you so much for joining us. You're each treasured, you're valued, you have purpose today. Strive for excellence, take care of your heart, your soul, your mind, and your body. My friends, we were made for this moment. And thank you to the team I work with, producer Steve, producer Luke, Zach, Patty, Keith, Charlie, Echo, all the people here at Crawford Broadcasting. I am just blessed to work with amazing people. Check out our website, that is Kim Munson, MUNSON.com. Sign up for our weekly email newsletter, and you'll get first look at our upcoming guests as well as our most recent essays. You can email me at Kim@KimMunson.com. And thank you to all of you who support us. We are an independent voice. We search for truth and clarity by looking at these issues through the lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. If something's a good idea, you should not have to force people to do it. And for this week of Independence Day week, we are recording all of these shows, because we want to celebrate Independence Day. The team wants to take a little bit of time off. And so we have arranged for amazing guests. And one of those guests, a fan favorite, is Dr. Douglas Grotius. He is a professor of philosophy at the Denver Seminary, the author of 18, almost 19 books. Dr. Douglas Grotius, it is so good to have you here.
Well, thank you. Happy to be back.
And we're going to talk about this book that you had written regarding the summer of love, if you will. The summer of, what was it, 2020? You'd written this book, Fire in the Streets, How You Can Confidently Respond to Incendiary Cultural Topics or Culture Topics. And we interviewed you shortly after the book was published. Have things changed? What do you want people to know?
Well, I think the problems that I address in this book are still with us. And it's, in some ways, the battle of ideologies, or the ideology of what's called critical race theory versus really American ideals, or you might say Americanism. That's how I really frame it in the book. And we hear a lot about critical race theory in the schools, in politics, in media, and so on. And it's really a hot topic. I'm not sure a lot of people know what it is. You know what it means. Some people say, well, it's just a boogeyman. There's nothing to worry about. We just need to talk about race in the schools and have equity in politics. But if I can find a nutshell for it, critical race theory is a neo-Marxist theory that really understands society essentially and primarily in terms of race. So all problems are essentially, at their base, racial problems. So it's a kind of dualism where you have an oppressor class, which would be the white race, and also especially white males, who are responsible for all the inequities in society, really. So if you want to talk about income disparities or educational disparities, whatever it is, the problem really goes down to race. So instead of making being a human being the essential category, and from a Judeo-Christian viewpoint, that is the essential category. We're made in the image and likeness of God, and we are put where we are. We are who we are because God is our creator. Instead of that, or instead of the idea that all men are created equal, which is part of the American creed, the idea is that the most important thing about anybody is their race. So it's a group identity. It's a kind of identitarian politics or identity politics. And I don't take it to be true or helpful at all. Now, when I give talks on this, I often have to say that simply because I am a opponent of critical race theory, it doesn't mean I deny the fact of racism today, or that I deny that the American system, sadly, in the past, has been racist with slavery, Jim Crow laws, redlining, and so on. I certainly affirm that. But the issue is fundamental worldview. Who are we as human beings? Is the American creed something to be preserved or something to be overthrown? And in the summer of 2020, during the George Floyd riots, a lot of people are saying some very revolutionary things, in the bad sense of revolutionary, meaning we need to revolt against the entire American way of life, the entire American system. So there was a book that came out during that time called In Defense of Looting. And you remember, there were far more than just protests in 2020. There was looting, it was burning, pillaging, multi-millions of dollars of damage, people killed, people injured, police being intimidated by mobs, and so on. And this book came out and said, well, looting is justified because these big companies have millions upon millions or billions of dollars, and they've essentially stolen it because profit is wrong intrinsically. See, this is a neo-Marxist view. And so there's nothing wrong with people that don't have stealing from those that have. And the person that wrote this book was actually interviewed on National Public Radio and received no criticism at all about the view. So the idea is that America is fundamentally, systemically unjust because it's fundamentally and systemically racist. It's baked into the system, as they say. And if it's baked into the system, the only way to change it is to completely deny what America is all about.
Well, Dr. Douglas Grotius, what I found so interesting regarding the summer of 2020 is there was actually equity by the looters, that they not only looted people that that were white and their businesses, but people of color as well. And so it really, when you drill down even just a little bit, it doesn't hold up. We should call it in defense of stealing.
Sure, that's what it is. One of the commandments is you shall not steal. And sometimes Martin Luther King is quoted as saying that riots are the language of the desperate or the language of desperation. And I would agree with that, but it's foul language. It's not the way to generate constructive change. And the deep thesis of my book is not just a critique of critical race theory as a neo-Marxist and false theory, but it's that the United States as a civilization has the resources in our, what you could call American creed, to reform for the better. We've seen that in many ways. We've seen that with the civil rights movement and the end of the Jim Crow era laws and so on. So we have in our Declaration and in the Constitution these wonderful, marvelous documents, as Martin Luther King put it in his speech. And we don't want to destroy those. See, there's this idea that because America began when many of the states allowed for slavery, that the whole structure and system is corrupt and irredeemable, really. We need to start over again somehow. And this is the Marxist idea that society is built on the backs of the oppressed. The neo-Marxist view of critical race theory really focuses on race as the main issue, not so much the economic categories, but it still uses the economic categories. So it would say if the average income of whites is higher than the average income of blacks, the explanation of that is racism. And the way to treat that is to target the haves and redistribute the wealth and the benefits to the have-nots through the state. So the whole idea here is very socialistic, very top-down. And it might be helpful to talk about the distinction between the idea of equality and equity, because the Declaration says that we take these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and have certain rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So this idea of created equality means that we are fundamentally valuable in the eyes of God, whatever our race, whatever our abilities, whether we're male or female. And that's a theological assertion. You can't generate that from Darwinism or from pantheistic worldview. It's a Judeo-Christian idea right there. So the way that has played out at its best in the American system is that we want people to have equal opportunities to advance according to their abilities. That's what you might call meritocracy. But the idea of equity says, no, meritocracy is a ruse for racism. So in critical race theory, everything that seems to have benefited people of color is really a ruse for racism. The civil rights movement really didn't accomplish very much, et cetera. You see this in the thinking of Derrick Bell and so on. So what we need to do is not, as we say, level the playing field or give people equal opportunity. That just hasn't worked out very well. So we have to ensure that people of color and other minorities are equally represented in various areas of life. Use the word that fits here, quotas. So if 13% of the American population is African-American and we don't have 13% of the pilots African-American or the engineers African-American, then the explanation is racism. And the answer is to change the whole system so that you have this supposedly proportional representation. And the way this plays out, and there's a very good book about this, just came out by Heather MacDonald, called When Race Trumps Merit. It plays out by changing the standards and artificially advancing people because of their gender or because of their race in order to fill out these quotas. Now, the civil rights vision is to give people equal opportunity to advance according to their skills. You remember Martin Luther King said, "I hope my little children will be judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin." So my thesis in this book is that because we live in a fallen world and people are sinners before God, we will see selfishness, we'll see racism, but critical race theory is not the way to address these problems. Trying to tear down American ideals and impose a top-down socialist authoritarian system, which is really what critical race theory demands, is not the American way. It's not good, ultimately, for people.
Well, and I think the great thing about the American idea is it's focused on the sanctity of the individual. And so to define people in a group, there's no way that a group can care about an individual the way an individual cares about themselves. And so I think that it's so important to understand that ultimately this does not bode well for anyone. Somebody said that in socialism, communism, ultimately is we're equal for sure, but we'll all be equal in our misery, which mm-hmm. is, I think, that's antithetical to the American idea. So I'm talking with Dr. Douglas Grotius. He's a professor of philosophy at Denver Seminary. We're talking about his book, Fire in the Street. And he had written that in a response to the summer of 2020 when we saw rioting and looting. It was unbelievable to see that mm-hmm. in America. We get to have these important conversations because of great sponsors. One of those great sponsors is the Roger Mangan State Farm Insurance Team. And Roger's been serving his community for 47 years. He's provided for his family and given back to these communities of Centennial, Littleton, Highlands Ranch, Inglewood, Greenwood Village, and Castle Rock. He's been taking care of his clients for all those years as well. So for more help with your insurance needs, call Roger Mangan at 303-795-8855. Like a good neighbor, the Roger Mangan State Farm Insurance Team is there.
Most of us have been there. That surprise crunch when you backed into a car in a parking lot or someone rear-ended you at a stoplight. First thing you do is stop and breathe. Second, say a prayer of gratitude that no one was hurt. Third, look for your insurance card. And fourth, be grateful that you have your insurance with Roger Mangan State Farm Insurance Agency. You can breathe easier knowing that you can reach the Roger Mangan team 24/7 when you need them. For that Roger Mangan State Farm Insurance peace of mind, call Roger Mangan today at 303-795-8855. That's 303-795-8855.
Eyes peeled and moving quickly, Lance Corporal Jack Swan led 164 of his fellow U.S. Marines from Mike Company, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines over the face of a bare rocky knoll to rescue an isolated company of fellow leathernecks besieged by the communist North Vietnamese Army. Then, all hell broke loose. Instead of rescuing their fellow comrades, the Marines now faced complete annihilation. Author Doyle Glass tells their story in Swift Sword, a true Vietnam War story of epic courage and brotherhood in the face of insurmountable odds. Order Swift Sword by Doyle Glass now. They never gave up. We should never forget.
Focused and wise marketing is essential for your success, especially during tough economic times. If you love the Kim Munson Show, strive for excellence and understand the importance of engaging in the battle of ideas that is raging in America. Then talk with Kim about partnership, sponsorship opportunities. Email Kim at kimmunson.com. Kim focuses on creating relationships with individuals and businesses that are tops in their fields. So they are the trusted experts listeners turn to when looking for products or services. Kim personally endorses each of her sponsors. Again, reach out to Kim at KimMunson.com.
And welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That is KimMunson.com. Sign up for our weekly email newsletter. You'll get first look at our upcoming guests as well as our most recent essays. You can email me at Kim at KimMunson.com. And thank you to all of you who support us. We are an independent voice on an independent station searching for truth and clarity by looking at these issues through the lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. If something's a good idea, you shouldn't have to force people to do it. In studio with me is Dr. Douglas Groteis. He is a professor of philosophy at the Denver Seminary. He's the author of 18, soon to be 19 books. Dr. Groteis, I just wanted to ask you a question. We were talking about equality and equity. Mm-hmm. And my dad, when I was a kid, said that, and I figured this out, this is the equity, that we all have 24 hours in a day. There's equity in that. Mm-hmm. But then we each choose what we do with those 24 hours and all those minutes. And so we will have unequal outcomes mm-hmm. because we make different decisions. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, exactly. And this is one of my many problems, many critiques of critical race theory, is that it assumes that unequal outcomes are always due to racism. Now, some are, especially if you go back 40 years, 50 years, 100 years in the United States. But today we really have more of an equality of opportunity for people of all races, given legal changes. And so you have to really consider agency, you know, personal responsibility. What do you do with your time? What is your worldview? What is your sense of work, family, savings, deferred gratification? All these are very significant in terms of outcomes with respect to things like education and income. And what critical race theory people do is just forget about all that and say, well, we have unequal outcomes. That is, we don't have statistically proportional outcomes. Therefore, the immediate cause of that has to be racial discrimination. And in fact, in the United States, for over 50 years, we've had things like affirmative action to give people of color a leg up in terms of their skin color. Actually, I'm a critic of affirmative action. I have been for like 40 years because I read Thomas Sowell 40 years ago, the great black economist, and he said it doesn't really help people of color. It's an artificial advancement. It tends to create suspicion. So if you see a person of color as a doctor or in some other position, you might think, well, why are they there? Are they there because they're the best at what they do, or are they there because of an affirmative action policy? So I've been a critic of that for a long time, and I have a criticism of that in the book also. And then you also have these ideas, well, there's been so much injustice in the past that we need to have reparations for African Americans because African Americans' ancestors suffered so much and were denied so much under slavery. And I've got five or six pages critiquing that as well. In fact, California is now talking about giving millions of dollars to African Americans as reparations. That, I don't think, is helpful or even just. Because for one thing, you have to trace some kind of causal history in terms of who you are. Now, if your ancestors are from a country in Africa that didn't have slaves, like Kenya, well, then why do you deserve reparations if your ancestors were not enslaved? So there's this question of knowledge. How do you determine? Just because you're black doesn't mean that there's a slavery history. There may be, there may not be. And moreover, the people that perpetuated slavery are long dead, and the people who were directly affected are long dead. And you have to say, is this really just? Who is making reparations to whom? And then you have to also look at the pragmatic question. And I go back to the 60s, the Great War on Poverty under Lyndon Johnson, and the idea was we need to use a phrase from a later President Barack Obama, spread the wealth around, because people in the inner cities, people of color, don't have as much money. So we need to take the money from, quote unquote, the rich, redistribute it, create these massive programs especially in the inner cities. And what has been the result of that? Well, there have been some positive results, but people like Charles Murray in his book, Losing Ground, and Thomas Sowell and others have pointed out, this has created a culture of dependency and a culture of entitlement among many people of color, and it's really undermined a sense of agency or responsibility. And I really like the approach of Robert Woodson. You may have heard of him.
I've had him on the show.
Oh, terrific. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really wanted to get him to endorse my book. I couldn't get through to him. But his approach has been African-Americans are human beings who have agency. And even if whites are against you, that doesn't mean you're going to fail. And it doesn't mean that somehow the white culture owes you anything except equality, you know, except equal opportunity. And I think
so
that
the
approach,
choice with your 24 hours in the
exactly,
day to go to
yes.
make your decisions for your 24 hours.
Right.
Yes,
exactly. And I like that approach. That's the approach of human agency. There's another guy I really like is Shelby Steele, mm-hmm. who is an African-American historian. He started out as a black radical in the 60s and 70s. And he eventually saw that the civil government was not the ultimate answer to black poverty or to any kind of deep poverty and being disadvantaged. And he speaks a lot about the need for agency and responsibility. And he believes that a lot of the policies of the far left, and that would be critical race theory, are based on what he calls white guilt. His whole book called White Guilt. It's somehow, whites feel guilty that they have more in some cases than blacks. And so this is behind the policies of let's redistribute the wealth, let's force equity and so on. But there are these unintended consequences. We saw that certainly in the war on poverty. For example, there used to be a program called something like Aid to Dependent Mothers. And if you had one illegitimate child and no father at home, you got a certain amount of money, a woman. If you have two illegitimate children at home and no father at home, you got more money. Well, what kind of perverse incentive is that? The incentive is to destabilize the family. Now, nobody intended that. They didn't say, let's create a law to destroy the black family or to cause it to be weaker. But that actually was the effect of that. So I'm a principled conservative. I argue for limited government, individual responsibility. And I think that's more the American approach to these kinds of problems. I don't think that socialism is the right approach. I don't think that constant appeals to systemic racism to explain everything. I don't think those are good explanations historically or in social science either. So I dedicated my book to Dr. Thomas Sowell, not because I have met him or he's been a mentor, but through his books, I've learned how to view society and social stratification and racial issues in a way that I think makes a lot more sense than what you're given by a highly ideological neo-Marxist or cultural Marxist theory. He still didn't write me a card back, but darn it. Maybe
know,
one of these days.
I
would love to meet him sometime. I have so much respect for him.
I would love to do that as well. And I've quoted him on the show somewhat regularly. Because he's just very wise, but he grew up in Harlem, mm-hmm. and he's a Korean War veteran, mm-hmm. and now, Stanford, Hoover Institute mm-hmm. at Stanford, right?
Yeah, he's 92, and he's still publishing books. He has a new book coming out in about a month. I think it's called Social Justice Fallacies or something like that. Can't wait to read that.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm talking with Dr. Douglas Groteis. He's a professor of philosophy at the Denver Seminary, the author of 18 books. And we get to have these great conversations because of wonderful sponsors. And I know that each of them strive for excellence.
Boson Law fights for clients who've been injured or family members who have lost a loved one due to the careless, reckless, or wrongful conduct of others. Whether injured in a car accident, suffered an injury due to a product or bad pharmaceutical drug, or need help fighting for medical care and benefits following an accident at work, don't go it alone and uninformed. Boson Law is the law firm you need in your corner. Time is of the essence with any personal injury claim. Call 303-999-9999 to schedule your complimentary consultation. That number again is 303-999-9999. Call now.
There are always opportunities in changing markets, and the metro real estate market is no exception.
That is why you need to work with seasoned RE/MAX Alliance Realtor Karen Levine when you buy your home, sell your home, consider the opportunities of a new build, or explore investment properties. Rising interest rates are spurring creativity, innovation, and opportunity in the real estate and mortgage markets. Kim Munson highly recommends award-winning RE/MAX Realtor Karen Levine. Call Karen Levine today at 303-877-7516 for answers to all your real estate questions. That's 303-877-7516.
You'd like to get in touch with one of the sponsors of The Kim Munson Show, but you can't remember their phone contact or website information. Find a full list of advertising partners on Kim's website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim, MONSON.com.
And welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly email newsletter. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. Thank you to all of you who support us. We are an independent voice. We search for truth and clarity by looking at these issues through the lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. If something's a good idea, you should not have to force people to do it. Wanted to mention a great sponsor of the show, of both the Kim Munson Show and America's Veteran Stories, and that is Hooters Restaurants. They have five locations: Loveland, Aurora, Lone Tree, Westminster, and Colorado Springs. They have great specials for lunch and happy hour Monday through Friday. So a great place to get together with friends. And how they became sponsors is really a story about freedom and free markets and capitalism. And you can find that story at kimmunson.com. In studio with me is Dr. Douglas Groteis. He is a professor of philosophy at the Denver Seminary. We're talking about one of his most recent books, and that is Fire in the Streets, How You Can Confidently Respond to Incendiary Culture Topics. And Dr. Groteis, you had mentioned something regarding the American Creed. Mm-hmm. And what do you want people to know about that?
We've recently celebrated Independence Day, and it's important for us to know as Americans what our history is, because this is fundamental to our identity, to our civil government, to our sense of ethos as a nation. And we hear a lot today about people's sexual identities, how they identify, and that's another topic. But I want to go right to the Declaration of Independence, because we may take this for granted, but it's quite remarkable that a nation would begin with a kind of declaration of principle. So I want to read a bit of this, and then I'll talk about what I think are eight factors of the American Creed. The unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. Such marvelous writing, and so much philosophy packed in there. So the next section is maybe more recognizable to many of us. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Now, it's a basic principle of politics today that those who are conservative emphasize the Declaration of Independence, and those that are more liberal and on the left want to forget about it because it's so theistic. It's so rooted in the metaphysics of God granting inalienable rights. Now, the statement is not there that we're made in the image and likeness of God, but that is really assumed by this statement. But let me go on and talk about what I take to be elements of the American Creed. And I talk about this on pages 42 and 43 of my book, Fire in the Streets. America is a republic, affirming that civil government is only legitimately constituted upon the consent of the governed. That is so significant. And this idea of a republic really traces back to the idea of a covenant. We think of the covenants in the Bible. And it's not merely a contract or some kind of contingent social arrangement, but it's more like a sacred relationship of civil government based on the consent of the governed, and really in the American situation, in the fear of God. Two, America recognizes the potential and weakness of human nature, so it does not concentrate power in any single branch of government. So we don't have a king. We have the three branches of civil government, which should be balanced against each other. Three, America affirms and promotes religious and political freedom, equality, and opportunity. Four, America allows for and encourages upward mobility through individual initiative. We talked about that. The rags to riches story, or attaining the American dream, not through state action. So five, America is a beacon for the nations, or a city set on a hill, as Cotton Mather said in a famous sermon. This was also reaffirmed by Ronald Reagan in his presidency. We are a sacred trust between God and we the people. That doesn't mean we're the new Israel. It doesn't mean America gets a pass from God when we sin. Israel didn't even get that. God judged his own people when they sinned egregiously enough. But the idea is that we are exceptional. We're an exceptional nation. We have great gifts, great opportunities, great abilities, and we're held accountable for all these possibilities before a holy God. So six, America endeavors to honor and hold true to its founding documents. Thus, calling something unconstitutional in America is a reproach. All right. Seven, America is a place where moral and political reform is possible within the founding ideals and without violence. Eight, America is a land that welcomes legal immigrants who want to become Americans and find a better life. Now, I think this creed is really found in our founding documents, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and by salient aspects of our history, such as the Revolutionary War, freedom from England, the Civil War, freedom for African Americans, World War II, the victory over fascism, and the Cold War, the victory over communism. So there's so much more to be said, but people on the left or people who hold to critical race theory will immediately say, but what about the fact that Thomas Jefferson, the principal writer of the Declaration of Independence, owned slaves? Why did it take America so long to abolish slavery? Well, that is a complicated story. Now, people can write better than they live. People can talk better than they live. Jefferson was actually conflicted about slavery. And slavery was deeply embedded into certain aspects of American society for a very long time.
And so, it was prevalent throughout the world. People
yes.
need to understand
oh, indeed.
That.
Yeah, it's not like slavery never existed until white slavers went to Africa and kidnapped all these blacks and brought them to America, and that's the first time slavery ever existed. Slavery is just endemic in a fallen world.
Mm-hmm.
It's sad. Thomas Sowell's written about this. Others have written about it. It's too bad it took us that long to get rid of slavery. But another issue is slavery was not the fact in every single state of the Union. It was in the South. And the documents that we have in the American Creed, as I put it, really don't square with slavery. Now, some people say, well, wait a minute, the Constitution says that black people are three-fifths human.
And I wanted to ask you about yeah. that, yes.
Yeah, briefly, I have about 6 or 7 pages on this. But it's a compromise in the Constitution because the North and the South had to come up with a Constitution. Otherwise, there would be two nations, not one nation. So the three-fifths clause actually limits the representation of the southern states in Congress because it counts slaves, although the word slave is never used, as three-fifths. That doesn't mean a slave is considered three-fifths human in some metaphysical sense. It was a way of limiting the representational power of the South in the Congress by the North. It was a compromise. It's sad the compromise had to happen at all, but it's not an endorsement of black human beings as having three-fifths the value of white human beings. We hear that on the left all the time. I even sometimes hear conservatives say it. They don't know what they're talking
about.
They
don't know what they're talking about. This was my understanding, Dr. Grotius, is that when they were working through the Constitution and they were talking about representation, House of mm-hmm. Representatives, which the votes on that would be via population.
Right. Yes.
Well, then the southern states said, hey, we want to count all mm-hmm. these people. And they're acknowledging mm-hmm. at that point that they are inherently human. And the northern states said, wait a minute, because they are not free human beings.
Exactly.
That doesn't seem like that's fair. And so that's where they came up with the three-fifths compromise.
That's it.
But our here people all the time mm-hmm. say that, oh, it's because that they looked at slaves as three-fifths of being a human, and it's just not true.
Not at all. Yeah, it's Article 1, Section 2. I was blessed many years ago. I read an excellent article in Commentary Magazine about this, which I refer to quite a bit in my book. I deal with this on pages 53 to 55. But it is something you hear all the time. And it's part of this story that America is racist, corrupt from the beginning. So we really have to tear it all down and start over again.
But that whole narrative is based on something that is false. And so mm-hmm. if that's false over there, we have to wonder what else is false about this narrative that mm-hmm. is being pushed onto young people. A lot of young people do not know that about the three-fifths clause.
Well, a lot of young people just don't know American history. They don't know civics. They don't know basic facts about reading and writing and arithmetic. And a lot of American state education, or what we call public education, is extremely ideologically driven by Marxist or neo-Marxist ideas. And we see this with plummeting test results in mathematics, in reading, in basic history. So one of the things I say in my book, I don't just critique critical race theory, but I have a final section of the book that talks about what we can do about it. That section is called A Better Fire. Chapter 8, I deal with a Christian framework for civil government and society. And then Chapter 9, I give some specifics. But one thing I'm very keen on, and I have been literally for 40 years, I'm an old guy, I'm 66, is that we need to have a strong system or a strong program of private schools, family education, and individual initiative for education. That is, don't assume the state has the responsibility or the ability to rightly educate children. So we need homeschooling, private schooling, charter schools. Now, charter schools are still under the authority of the state, but they have a lot more freedom and possibility. Thomas Sowell wrote a book on this a few years ago called Charter Schools and Their Enemies. And he showed with meticulous research, he said it was his most well-researched book, which is amazing, that disadvantaged children, like in inner city, many of them people of color, do extremely well in these charter schools. And it's because these charter schools are not dominated by the liberal teachers union, mm-hmm. and they have more parent involvement, and they have stricter standards. What do you know?
How does that work out?
Yeah, how does that work? You don't just let the little beasties express themselves and then indoctrinate them into Marxism. You actually teach them the basic skills needed for civil society.
Yeah. And I will just clarify that that was all tongue-in-cheek, as you were calling them beasties as we look at kids.
Yeah. I just mean little sinners. You know, we're all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. But Thomas Sowell has another book, which he thinks is his most important book, which is called The Conflict of Visions. And there are two essential political visions. One is the constrained vision, that we are limited beings, that there will be no earthly utopia. The state will not bring about heaven on earth. And there's the unconstrained view, which says that all of our problems are based on social structures. And if we just get the social structures right, change everything around, let people express themselves, that we will find a better society. Now, of course, the Christian view is the constrained vision.
And of course, and ultimately, the unconstrained will devolve into chaos. And we
right.
can see that happening.
And authoritarianism. Yeah.
Yeah. And what happened in 2020, fire in the streets. I'm talking mm-hmm. with Dr. Douglas Grotius about his book. I did want to mention the USMC Memorial Foundation. It is a nonprofit that I dearly love. And Paula Sarles is she's the president of the Marine Memorial Foundation. She's also a Gold Star wife and a Marine veteran. And she is diligently, her and her team, raising money for the remodel of the Marine Memorial out at 6th and Colfax. And you can honor them by going to usmcmemorialfoundation.org to make a contribution. That is usmcmemorialfoundation.org. And we'll be right back.
Lavaca Meat Company takes great pride in selling only the best. Lavaca Meat Company is a third-generation family-owned business with its roots in eastern Colorado. Lavaca means the cow in Spanish. As our name implies, we only sell beef. No poultry, pork, bison, or game. Just premium quality, aged, mouth-watering beef. Our store is located at the corner of Main and Nevada in the historic Coors Building in downtown Littleton. For a steakhouse experience at home, visit us in person or shop online at lavacameat.com. Lavaca Meat Company, only the best. Again, that's lavacameat.com.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
Shooting outside in winter isn't great, but at Franktown Firearms 10-lane, 30-yard indoor range, conditions are always ideal. Franktown's range is ready for handguns, shotguns, rifles up to 50 caliber, and even black powder. Plus, safety gear is always free to use. Since the range connects to their full-service gun store, you can rent a variety of firearms and try before you buy, making sure it's the right fit for you. And with the Franktown membership, you even get after-hours access to the range. Ventilation is top-notch with fresh air constantly circulated, so you can breathe easy while you shoot. Family-owned and operated, Franktown Firearms treats clients with respect, aiming to build your confidence and make this your home on the range. Bring your own gun or try something new today. And KLZ listeners, for a limited time, will receive a free gun rental with any range lane purchase. Visit klzradio.com/Franktown to find out why Franktown Firearms is where friends are made.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly email newsletter. And you can email me at Kim@KimMunson.com as well. Thank you to all of you who support us. We're an independent voice. We search for truth and clarity by looking at these issues through the lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. If something's a good idea, you shouldn't have to force people to do it. Did want to mention a couple of things. First of all, Jansen Photography, which is located out here in Lakewood, Colorado. They have a beautiful property. So beautiful landscapes for that family portrait. Portraits of children, those senior portraits that get your appointment made for that. And, of course, that important photo for your business or political career. You can get more information at jansenphotography.com. And then also the Center for American Values that is located on the Riverwalk right here in Pueblo, Colorado. Pueblo is known as the home of heroes. There are four Medal of Honor recipients that called Pueblo home, and it is just a really extraordinary place. They're open 7 days a week, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and it's focused on these great American principles of honor, integrity, and patriotism. So for more information, go to AmericanValueCenter.org. In studio with me is Dr. Douglas Grotius. He is a professor of philosophy at the Denver Seminary, author of 18 books. We're talking about his book, Fire in the Streets, but you are working on your 19th book, yes?
Yeah, actually, it's done. It'll be out in about 2 months, and this is a book about comparative religion. It's called World Religion in Seven Sentences. I had a previous book called Philosophy in Seven Sentences, and the idea is to take significant sentences from the world's religions and then use that as a point of entry to discussing the truth claims of the worldviews. So I look at, start out actually with atheism, Nietzsche, God is dead, critique that, and then look at Judaism, Christianity, Islam, all the major world religions.
Oh, my gosh. That's fascinating. I can't wait. So we'll have to get you back on the show
sure.
on that.
Yeah, I'd love to do that, too.
Okay, Dr. Douglas Grotius, the book that we've been talking about today is Fire in the Streets, How You Can Confidently Respond to Incendiary Culture Topics, which is important. You wrote this after, quote, in air quotes, the summer of love, the summer of destruction 2020. Mm-hmm. What about free speech in all of this?
Right. And I should say that the title of the book doesn't have the word critical race theory in it or the word woke in it. And if we get to a second edition, I really want to put that in there because the book is really about wokeness and about critical race theory. But this is a tremendous concern I have because the First Amendment says that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion, so no state church, or prohibiting the free exercise of religion or abridging the freedom of speech or press and so on. So this has to do with the civil government, but it's also very much part of the American ethos and DNA that ideas should be publicly debated and disputed, and may the best argument win, essentially. And John Stuart Mill said, if you only know your position, you probably don't know your position very well. So if you only know what capitalism is, you don't know anything about socialism, how well can you defend capitalism or the free market, let's say? So this is really a very significant element of the American creed, is freedom to debate ideas publicly and marshal evidence and argument, and may the best argument win. Now, I'm a philosopher, so that's what I attempt to do all the time at my best. But what we see with critical race theorists is that society is divided into the oppressors and the oppressed. And the oppressors are white men, Christians, essentially.
Straight men.
Straight, yes. Yeah, so I put in their heteronormative, so to speak. And they oppress everyone else. And in fact, these folks don't have the right to be heard. So it's not like we want you to advance your ideas defending the free market or defending a Judeo-Christian worldview or defending the ideals of America. We just want you to go away. We don't want you to talk at all. So it's not like we'll give you the microphone and then we'll take the microphone. We don't want you to have the microphone at all. This is called cancel culture. We're seeing it everywhere in society, in the academy, in politics, in entertainment, and so on. And it's based on a very toxic notion that some ideas do not deserve to be heard, do not deserve to be debated. You have to simply eliminate them. Now, if you believe that there is such a thing as objective truth, and objective truth is knowable, and if you believe that reason is something to be used to find objective truth, then you have to be opposed to this idea. But a lot of it comes back to one of the leading theorists of critical race theory, goes back to the 30s and onward, a man named Herbert Marcuse, who is the main philosopher of the New Left in the American counterculture in the 60s and 70s. He wrote an essay where he said we should not be tolerant of conservative viewpoints because those are the ideological views that hold people in subjection. So these folks, the people who defend American ideals or free market, are intrinsically toxic, and their ideas have to be silenced. So our ideas, our neo-Marxist ideas, can ascend and gain power. And he wrote a whole essay on this back, I believe it was in the 1960s. And this is now everywhere in our society, and it plays itself out in cancel culture.
So, Dr. Grotius, I'm thinking about culture, how we got to this point. But you mentioned objective truth. Mm-hmm. Don't you remember the narrative, oh, you have your truth, I have my truth, we agree to disagree? Instead of debating the ideas, and that if you get to a point where the other idea has made the case, made it on the merits, mm-hmm. then just walk away and go, oh, I have my truth, or we'll agree mm-hmm. to disagree. Mm-hmm. I always felt that was a bit of a cop-out.
Oh, it is. I wrote a book many years ago called Truth Decay about postmodernism. And what we're seeing in critical race theory is a kind of a new version of postmodernism, where it says that the lived experience of oppressed people is the final word. So if a Hispanic man says, I'm oppressed and I'm targeted by the police and our whole system is corrupt and we have to bring it down, you say, well, you as a Hispanic man or Hispanic woman or black man or black woman have been oppressed horribly. And so your viewpoint is automatically beyond critique. Now, it's a half truth. It's a whole lie, because sure, I have no idea what it's like to be an African-American male. I'm a white male. I have no idea what it's like to be a Latina, a female Hispanic person. So I need to listen to those folks and talk to them and interact with them. But simply being a person of color doesn't make you an expert on the Three-Fifths Clause or on American history or what American ideals are or what would actually advance people overall. So the postmodern view was, it's all perspective, there's no objective truth, but beware of these narratives that try to explain everything, like mm-hmm. Christianity. The critical race theory version of it is, well, it's all perspective, but there's one perspective that trumps all the rest, and that is the perspective of the lived experience of the oppressed. Now, that viewpoint says, well, we don't need to hear from the oppressors because they've set up the whole system to be unfair to the oppressed. So we have to hear the oppressed and take their word for it. But people are not even consistent on this because, all right, there are black folks that have differences of opinion. You know, if you have the opinions of Abraham X. Kendi and of Thomas Sowell, both African-Americans, they're radically different. It's not that one viewpoint is black and one viewpoint is not black. They're both black. You deal with ideas not according to pigmentation, but according to rationality. But now we're trying to pigmentize truth and make truth ethnically relative, and that just undermines civil discourse. I'll give you an example. I won't give you any specifics because I get in trouble. But we're talking about my book, Fire in the Streets. I'm a white male, 66 years old. And I know of some Christian people who said, oh, we don't even have to read Grotius's book because he's white. He's white, so therefore he has nothing to say about the racial issue. Hmm. Well, I call that literary racism. Racism can go in all directions, you know. Mm-hmm. Whites can be racist against blacks, blacks against whites, Latinos against blacks. Racism can occur all over the place.
And what I think it is, Douglas, is that it's defining people by the color of their skin instead of the content of their character.
Yeah, and the quality of their ideas.
Right. Right.
The quality of their ideas. So I like to say I would rather be refuted in an argument than canceled. You know, let's have a good discussion. And if you show that I'm wrong about something, then I hope I have the humility and integrity to say, you're right. I was wrong. So now I'm better for it. But we don't find that happening a lot. It's more, who do we want to center in the discourse and who do we want to decenter and even marginalize and cancel? And that's not a good idea if we're pursuing the truth about what matters most.
And so that's why what we do on the show, when I say that we are engaged in this great battle of ideas, we are. And one of the things is we need to make sure that we hear the ideas instead of having them canceled, which we got just a couple of minutes left, which brings us back to freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. And the founders knew that that was so important that they put that in the First Amendment in the Bill of Rights.
Exactly. And I really respect old line liberals like Alan Dershowitz. There aren't too many of them left. You know, Alan Dershowitz was a professor of law for many years, I believe, at Harvard. He's in his 80s now. He's liberal. He didn't vote for Donald Trump, but he thought Donald Trump had been mistreated. So he actually represented him as a lawyer. Now, I'm not a big Donald Trump fan, but see, the old liberals say, let's use the system, freedom of speech, the rule of law, and may the best people win or may the most effective people win. That's not critical race theory. Critical race theory is silence the opponents, do anything you can to marginalize them. It's not a view that honors free speech. It's a very anti-American, anti-truth and rationality kind of perspective.
Well, and it doesn't honor the individual either.
Right. No.
And that is really the beauty that we've been celebrating with our independence is the sanctity of the individual. And that is inherent in the American idea. Dr. Douglas Grotius, it is always a delight and treat to have you on the show. I greatly appreciate it. And people can get your book at all the places, can't they?
Yeah, it's certainly on Amazon. Hasn't been canceled yet there. Salem, my publisher, makes it available as well. Salem Books.
Okay. Dr. Douglas Grotius, great to have you here. And so I decided, because you talked a lot about Thomas Sowell, that I would do a Thomas Sowell quote at the end of the show. And he said this: it's amazing how much panic one honest man can spread among a multitude of hypocrites. I love that. So my friends, today, be grateful, read great books, think good thoughts, listen to beautiful music, communicate and listen well, live honestly and authentically, strive for high ideals, and like Superman, stand for truth, justice, and the American way. My friends, you are not alone. God bless you, and God bless America. Stay tuned for hour number two.
Live in freedom. Talking about freedom. Talking about freedom. I will fight for the right to live in freedom.
The views views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker, commentators, hosts, their guests, and callers. They are not necessarily the views and opinions of Crawford Broadcasting or KLZ management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.
It's The Kim Munson Show, analyzing the most important stories.
The socialization of transportation, education, energy, housing, and water, what it means is that government controls it through rules and regulations.
The latest in politics and world affairs.
Under this guise of bipartisanship and nonpartisanship, it's actually tapping down the truth.
Today's current opinions and ideas.
On an equal field in the battle of ideas, mistruths and misconceptions is getting us into a world of hurt.
Is it freedom or is it force? Let's have a conversation.
Indeed, and welcome to the Kim Munson Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You're each treasured, you're valued, you have purpose. Today, strive for excellence. Take care of your heart, your soul, your mind, and your body. My friends, we were made for this moment. And I get to work with an amazing team. That is producer Joe, producer Nicole, and Luke, Rachel, Zach, Echo, Charlie, all the people here at Crawford Broadcasting. We are an independent voice on an independent station, and we search for truth and clarity by looking at these issues through the lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. If something's a good idea, you should not have to force people to do it. And I am so pleased and honored to have on the line with me Dr. Alan Gelzo. He's an American historian, and he serves as senior research scholar in the Council of the Humanities and director of the Initiative on Politics and Statesmanship in the James Madison Program at Princeton University. And he formerly was a professor at the History of Gettysburg College. Dr. Gelzo, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Kim.
And it's so appropriate to have you as our first guest. The battle, which was in July, July 1 through July 3. Now the year, 1863, am I remembering it right?
Still 1863, yes.
Okay. The battle was in the summer. And I guess, first of all, let's talk about the significance of the battle. And I guess that's a great segue into your most recent book, Robert E. Lee, A Life. And Robert E. Lee, after the Battle of Gettysburg, can you imagine getting up and what was going through his mind on July 4 in 1863 after this battle?
Oh, I think it could be boiled down to one sentence, and that is, how do I get out of here?
True.
Because the great battle that occurs at Gettysburg on July 1, 2, and 3 of 1863 was really a major initiative of Lee's. This was really Lee's idea about how the Southern Confederacy, which had been carrying on this Civil War now for a little bit more than 2 years, this was a piece in what Lee thought was the only really workable strategy for the Confederacy to achieve independence from the United States. And he reasoned this way. The Southern Confederacy, which at this point is composed effectively of 11 states of the American South that have tried to secede from the Union, Lee understood the South didn't have the heft, economically, industrially, and otherwise, that the Northern states had. So that in going into this Civil War, the odds were all against the Confederacy. If the Confederacy was going to win, it was going to have to go into this heavyweight bout, trying to score a surprise knockout in the first round or two. Because if the war ground on after that, then the Confederacy would simply be worn down and worn away and would lose the war. So Lee's reasoning is, we have to take the initiative. This Confederate army, which he called the Army of Northern Virginia, has to jump from Virginia across the Potomac into Maryland, into Pennsylvania, and in the summer of 1863, it has to get loose in Pennsylvania, because if it does, if it can do that successfully, in fact, if it can find some way to fight a battle with the major United States force opposing it, which is the Army of the Potomac, his reasoning was that Northern public opinion would be so fatigued at this, it would be so revolted by it, that they would demand that the Lincoln administration enter negotiations with the Confederates. And at that point, once negotiations began, Lee understood no one was going to go back into this horrible fratricidal war. So Lee's gambling, but it's a good gamble. It's an intelligent gamble. And it had a lot going for it, because not only is he looking at the state of mind of Northerners, he's also looking at what's happened at election time. Back in the preceding November, Abraham Lincoln's party, the Republicans, had lost something like 35 seats in the House of Representatives and two key governorships in the North, governorship of New York, the governorship of New Jersey. Well, the governorships of Pennsylvania and Ohio were up for election in the fall of 1863. Lee knows if he can show that the Lincoln administration is helpless and impotent and can't deal with the Confederates who are invading Pennsylvania, then voters in Pennsylvania and Ohio are going to go to the polls, they're going to elect anti-administration governors, and that means you're going to have this central chunk of the northern states in opposition to Lincoln. And they can just fold their arms and say to President Lincoln, we're not cooperating with this war any longer. You're going to have to open negotiations with the Confederacy. And at that moment, really, it's inevitable. The Confederates are going to obtain their independence. So Lee launches this invasion of Pennsylvania. And yes, there's an element of a gamble to it, but it's a shrewd gamble. And the really terrifying thing about this, Kim, is how very close he came to winning that gamble. Because if Lee's army had been victorious at Gettysburg, as for two of the 3 days of the battle it really was, or even if it had just been able to run willy-nilly around the Pennsylvania countryside without the Union doing very much to stop them, it would have had an incredibly destructive effect. And perhaps we would be looking at a very different kind of America today than we were looking at in 1863, or that we look at today as it really exists.
Well, Dr. Gelzo, the Civil War, many people think that it was really a war about slavery, which ultimately that question, and it was really the question of would slavery be expanded into the new territories. That's my understanding. That was the initial kind of question on that. But what Lincoln looked at it as he wanted to keep the Union together. And was Lee looking more at like a states' rights issue, or how would you frame that?
Well, the causes of the American Civil War are always a lively subject of debate. And I like to get philosophical at moments like that and say, all right, let's talk about what causes something. There's a real sense in which sectionalism is one cause. Because if slavery had been legal, let's say, in Minnesota and Maine and Florida and Louisiana, there would never have been a civil war because they're not in a position to support each other. But the states where slavery was legal were all contiguous. They all shared common borders. You could look at a map and look at those slave states, and you could say, hey, I could see that would be a functioning, viable, independent nation. So sectionalism is one. There's another cause here, too, and that is federalism. I mean, ours is a federal system of government. It's states in a union under a federal constitution. But the habit of federalism led a lot of people think that the states somehow possessed a sovereignty of their own, which if you read the Constitution with any kind of care, you realize that's really not the case. But many people talked themselves into believing that states had that kind of sovereignty. And so it was easy in those days then to conclude, well, if states have that kind of sovereignty, then they can walk away from the Union. I mean, if that's not sovereignty, we don't know what is. But then ultimately there's slavery. Slavery is the one item in this equation, which if you take it out, there's no civil war. I don't care what the circumstances are. But put slavery back into the equation, that's when you get civil war. So at the end of the day, if people ask me to put my finger on one thing and call it the cause of the Civil War, there's simply no question. It was slavery. And you know the people who tell us that are the Southerners themselves. In the resolutions that their state conventions and legislatures passed at the very beginning of the Civil War in 1861, they're all very candid about this. We're doing this to protect slavery. Afterwards, in the years after the war, a lot of Southerners who were embarrassed by that would try to insist, well, no, it was about these other things. Well, yeah, to a certain degree, but not to a degree that put the issue of slavery in the shadow. If you've got to put your finger on one thing, it's slavery.
But many of those that fought on the Southern side did not own slaves. So how did they get co-opted into that?
Well, part of it was because you have to look carefully at what we mean by slave ownership. If you look at the Southern population right on the eve of the Civil War, probably slave ownership amounted to no more than one-third of the white population of the South.
It's quite a few, quite
but
a bit, though.
Yeah, that's a significant chunk in its own right. But it's actually more widespread than that, because you have to remember that slaves are not just owned by individuals. They're also owned by families. So, in fact, you can have someone who is a junior member of a family. Let's say someone who is an 18-year-old. All right, they may not be owning slaves in their own right, but they might be part of a family that does. At that moment, suddenly the percentage of Southerners who are involved in the slave system gets a lot bigger, just in mathematical terms. And then if you look at the composition of the Southern armies, especially at Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia, a very fine analysis of this was done by a colleague of mine, Joseph Glatthar, at the University of North Carolina. He analyzed the slave ownership patterns of the soldiers of Lee's army. There, the patterns of slave ownership were actually larger than at the than the percentages in the Southern population as a whole, so that the Confederate army actually had an even clearer investment in protecting slavery than you might say the population of the South as a whole. So don't underestimate, just by doing simple numerical calculations, don't underestimate the pervasiveness of the slave system, because many people who might not actually own a slave were involved in the slave system in a variety of ways.
Wow, fascinating. We have just a couple of minutes before we go to break. Let's just talk a little bit about your books that you've written a number of different books. The most recent was Robert E. Lee, but you also did a book on Gettysburg that I think is very important. And many of these books, I really highly recommend that people have them in hardback copy in their Freedom Libraries. Would you say that there is one book that you've written that stands out among the others, or would you say they're all equal in importance?
Kim, that's like asking me which is my favorite child. I could get in a lot of trouble that way. Of course, what I'm tempted to say is, oh, no, no, I regard them all equally. Therefore, your listeners should all go out and buy all of them. But the Gettysburg book is it's a significant book in a lot of ways. It's a very big book. It spent 8 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list when it came out back in 2013. And I would say I'm a little bit fond of it. I'm also fond of some of the stuff that I've done on the subject of Abraham Lincoln and my early book on Lincoln from 1999, Abraham Lincoln, Redeemer President. I suppose if I had to pick one off the line and say that one's my favorite, it might very likely be Redeemer President. But I have to say that writing Gettysburg was a tremendous amount of fun, because I was doing it right there in Gettysburg itself, so that I was talking about this great battle while being able to walk out my door and walk around over the very battlefield I was describing. And I think that gave me something of an advantage, in the sense that when I was talking about the battle, I wasn't just talking about a map and rectangles and squares moving across the map. I was actually looking at the lay of the land itself and seeing the ground as the participants in the battle had very much seen it. So that gave a particularly important attraction to the writing of that book.
Fascinating. And that book is Gettysburg, The Last Invasion by Dr. Alan Gelzo. And we're having a great conversation about the Gettysburg Address. This is being broadcast on the 20th, the day after the anniversary of the Gettysburg Address, and just such important conversations. We get to do this. I want to say thank you to the Harris family for their gold sponsorship of the show, and also thank you to the National Shooting Sports Foundation for their gold sponsorship of the show as well. And we get to do all this because we have amazing sponsors. And
we have these discussions on the show because I have amazing sponsors. One of those is on the line, John Boson with Boson Law. John, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Kim.
A lot is going on, and I wanted to just ask you again about people being hit by uninsured motorists. I was at the corner of Hamden and I-25, getting onto I-25, and as I came up to the corner, there was a car that had no license plate whatsoever.
And bear in mind, there is a piece of legislation going through the legislature right now that will have penalties if we do not have our driver's license with us, if you can believe it. There's that law. But I looked over and, making assumptions, it looked to me like it could be someone that had come here illegally. So probably didn't have a driver's license and didn't even have a license on the car. So this is getting more and more dangerous here in Colorado. What should people know?
Well, they should know that they have, for themselves, with their own auto insurance carrier, uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage. And I talk to people every day, Kim. And the vast majority of people, they don't know if they even have that coverage for themselves, that coverage that protects them if, or more and more, I say when, somebody hits you, causes an accident, it's their fault, they have no insurance coverage. Some of them are absolutely, nobody can deny it anymore. They're illegals that are getting cars. How are they getting cars? I don't know. But they're getting behind the wheel, don't have a driver's license, don't know the laws in our country, are causing accidents, fleeing the scene, or they stay at the scene. It doesn't matter. They don't have insurance coverage. They are not going to be able to take care of the damages, the injuries, the harm they cause to others by being here and driving on our streets when they shouldn't be.
So that is my next question, guys, John Boson, it surely seems like we, the people of Colorado, should be able to have some legal recourse. And it seems to me like that should go right to the elected representatives and bureaucrats that are responsible for all of these illegal aliens that are here. I know that's a long shot. I've kind of posed that question to you before, but what do you think about that today?
I think it's a viable option for the right situation, the right scenario. I and several others of my colleagues are looking for that case. It's going to be very interesting when it happens. But in the meantime, people out there, your listeners, need to know what kind of coverage they have. They need to make sure that they have that uninsured motorist coverage with their own auto insurance carrier. And if there's any question in their mind, they need to contact their agent, review their policy, get a copy of their declaration page, and see with their own eyes that confirmation that they've got that insurance coverage that will protect them in the event they have an accident with someone that has no insurance coverage. So important. We've talked about it time and time again, Kim. But on a regular basis, I talk with folks that tell me they've got full coverage and they don't know what they have. And then when they do look, they find out that to save some money, they waive that coverage. 9 out of 10 times, they really didn't understand what that coverage provided. So don't waive uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage, listeners. Get it. Make sure you have it. It's more important today than it has ever been in my 34 years of practicing law in the state of Colorado and handling personal injury matters for folks.
Well, and if someone is injured, whether or not in an auto accident or at work, to call you immediately is so important. What is that number, John Boson?
That number for a conversation with me or one of my other attorneys is 303-999-9999. And you're exactly right, Kim. Someone needs to call if they or someone they care about or someone they know has been involved in a situation where they've suffered harm. The sooner I can get on the phone with them, the better. I won't necessarily offer representation, but I will give advice, and that advice is timely and can make all the difference. When folks wait, bad stuff happens. So 303-999-9999 is the number to call.
And again, that's John Boson with Boson Law. John, we'll talk to you next week.
Kim, have a great rest of your show.
Thank you so much. And as As John had mentioned, it is so important to have uninsured motorist coverage. And so why don't you reach out to Roger Mangan at and his State Farm Insurance team and have a complimentary appointment with them to go over your insurance coverage. I've done that, and I greatly appreciate them. They carry my home and auto. And for more information, give them a call at 303-795-8855. Like a good neighbor, the Roger Mangan team is there.
Most of us have been there. That surprise crunch when you backed into a car in a parking lot or someone rear-ended you at a stoplight. First thing you do is stop and breathe. Second, say a prayer of gratitude that no one was hurt. Third, look for your insurance card. And fourth, be grateful that you have your insurance with Roger Mangan State Farm Insurance Agency. You can breathe easier knowing that you can reach the Roger Mangan team 24/7 when you need them. For that Roger Mangan State Farm Insurance peace of mind, call Roger Mangan today at 303-795-8855. That's 303-795-8855.
And welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. Sign up for our weekly email newsletter. And you can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. And thank you to all of you who support us. We are an independent voice on an independent station. And we search for truth and clarity by looking at these issues through the lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. If something's a good idea, you should not have to force people to do it. And we have pre-recorded these shows for the week of Thanksgiving and have very special guests. And we're kicking it off with Dr. Alan Gelzo. He's an American historian, and he serves as senior research scholar in the Council of the Humanities and director of the Initiative on Politics and Statesmanship in the James Madison program at Princeton. And he was a professor at Gettysburg College as well. And he is an amazing author. His most recent book is on Robert E. Lee. He has a very important book on Gettysburg, but you can get all of his books. You can go to his website, and that is, let me get it, it's Alan Gelzo. That's GUELZO.com. So it's ALLENGUELZO.com. Dr. Gelzo, before we went to break, we were talking about the book Gettysburg and that you were there, that going out onto the battlefield. And I've been to Gettysburg once, and it was too fast because I really would like to spend time there. But we actually ended up, I was with my daughter. She was moving from New York to Kansas City. And so we were driving from New York to Kansas City, obviously, and we stopped in Gettysburg, and it was during the summer, and we ended up at a farm-to-table event, and there were probably, I bet there were at least 30 people at this long table there at Gettysburg, and the home was an old, I think it was an old church. It was now a home, and there was actually a pew that they had there that had blood on it from when they were bringing in soldiers to operate on them. I guess it was a hospital. I think it was a church that became a hospital. And I kind of stood there and I am like, this is something that I'm experiencing. I couldn't quite put my hand on it, Dr. Gelzo.
Well, during the battle, almost every building in Gettysburg was liable to be impressed as a hospital facility of some sort. This is a battle that involves something on the order of 180,000 people. I'm talking right now just about the soldiers. 180,000 people who are either in uniform or they're working for the armies as civilian teamsters and whatnot. All of them compressed into a square of not more than 20 miles.
Wow.
Gettysburg, up to this point, had been a town whose population amounted to about 2,500 people. Suddenly, almost overnight, you have this stupendous influx. And, of course, it's not only 180 or 190,000 UN beings. It's all the horses that have to pull wagons and pull artillery. All of this now has to get compressed into this small space. And then, of course, the fighting itself begins. And the fighting is deadly. This is 19th century warfare, when everyone understood that casualty lists were going to be high. And they were. Generally speaking, we could probably say that at the Battle of Gettysburg, from both sides, something like 9,000 were killed Maybe we can guess, and it is a guesstimate, because in the 19th century they didn't really have terribly accurate ways of totaling these things. Probably about 4,000 to 4,500 dead on each side after 3 days of fighting. Take that and multiply that by anywhere from 3 to 5 times, and then you start to get a sense of the wounded. Just take it as a whole, probably about a third of each army ended up as a casualty of some sort. Well, for the wounded, where do you put them? There are no easily available hospitals. There are no ready-made facilities. So what you have to do is you have to set things up wherever you can find shelter. That means you take over houses, you take over barns, you take over churches, you take over anything with a roof, and sometimes you take over things that don't even have a roof. And the medicine of the 19th century, this is long before they have any understanding of germs or infection. The ways of dealing with casualties, with wounds, we would regard as being almost barbaric. Because if someone is wounded, let's say, in the arms or the legs, the only really secure treatment for that is amputation. If someone is wounded in the chest or in the abdomen, for the most part, they have to be set aside. Because the wounds are going to be fatal. They're either going to be fatal from loss of blood, or they're going to be fatal over a longer and more painful period of several days just from infection. And that kind of situation is enough to make our jaws drop in horror at the prospect. And yet this is going on all through the town of Gettysburg. It has to be done quickly. It has to be done hurriedly. The amputations can't be done with, in many cases, anesthetic of any sort.
Oh my gosh.
And the amputations themselves are being done by doctors who are quite literally using saws. We would look at it and say, well, that's what a carpenter does to deal with wood. No, that is what doctors had to deal with in the middle of the 19th century in cases like the Battle of Gettysburg. So it's not just that one building, Kim. There are a number of places scattered all around the Gettysburg area that were impressed for use as hospitals, which have stains like that. I've been in one house on the battlefield, for instance, that you can readily be taken to one part of the floor, the blood stains. Blood stains from the amputations, from the bleeding of the wounds, the stain was still there on the floorboards. And my experience has been that that can be repeated and pointed to in place after place, location after location in the Gettysburg area.
So, okay, Dr. Gelzo, I have to ask this question with these amputations. I mean, the loss of blood would be so significant. What did they do to stop that?
You tied them off like you tied the limbs off like a tourniquet. You sutured them up, and you hoped for the best. And sometimes your hope was rewarded, and sometimes it wasn't. The way that death stalked these armies occurs in a proportion that we would find simply unimaginable today. But yet in the 19th century, such was the nature of medicine and medical practice, they simply didn't have any other way of dealing with these things.
Goodness. It takes my breath away as I think about that. Okay, I've got the next question. And this last May, it was the first time that I'd made it to Virginia, to Monticello and Montpelier. Mm-hmm. And you said that ultimately the war came down to slavery, and Lee's army was the Army of Northern Virginia. How is it? So we have Thomas Jefferson, who writes these beautiful words in the Declaration that all men are created equal, and that can't match up with slavery. So how did this, the Virginia is now at war regarding slavery? Because if all men are created equal, you can't have slavery. How would you address that?
You address it by understanding that human nature follows ideals, but it also follows self-interest. And these two voices are often in competition with each other. It's almost like the good angel and the bad angel on your shoulder whispering in your ear. The ideal was the one captured by Jefferson in his words in the Declaration of Independence. And they are great ideals. And they are true. But self-interest said, Owning slaves is what makes us money. Slave labor is cheap. You don't have to pay wages to slaves. And you can work them for as long as you like and in as many ways as you like. Slaves never go on strike. There's no union for slaves. And so self-interest enters into it. And when self-interest collides with ideals, two things will happen. The ideals will win, and people will walk away from something like slavery. That's what we hope will happen, and indeed it did in many places in America, from the Revolution to the Civil War. But in many other places, people made the other choice. They made the choice of averting their eyes. They made the choice of denial. And sometimes that choice took the form of saying, well, these people whom we're enslaving, they're not really people like us, despite the fact that they're born and they die, they get sick, they get healthy, they have children, they have two arms, they have two legs, they have a head, they have eyes, they have a nose. They're human. But yet you look at them and you say, well, no, they're not really human, at least not human like us. And therefore, it's legitimate for us to enslave them. That becomes the excuse that people invent. And isn't this always the way human beings do things? When we decide we want to dispose of someone we find inconvenient, whether it's Jews in Germany, whether it's populations that are not wanted by larger populations, what's the first step towards genocide, dehumanization? Convince yourself and convince others that these people whom you plan to do something evil to really, really don't deserve anything more than what they're being given, because they're not really, again, like us. And when you start to think in those terms, that is when people start to give themselves permission to do all kinds of horrible things to each other. So there are two paths. There's the paths of the ideal, and the ideal is the one Jefferson captures in his words. But then there's the other path of self-interest, which Jefferson, alas, captures in his behavior, and which Southerners, despite their allegiance to a nation founded on that proposition that all men are created equal, nevertheless, self-interest persuaded them that they could invent a fantasy that would allow them to get away with the exact opposite of what the principles in the Declaration described.
Well, I think what we'll do is we'll go to break, because I want to talk about groups, because I see in 2023 America, if you can divide, as you say, define a person as not like us, and you start to put into groupthink instead of the individual, I think that's where we get into a lot of trouble, where people, humans, can inflict a lot of harm on other humans. I'm talking with Dr. Alan Gelzo. And a couple of things I wanted to mention. First of all, Hooters Restaurants is a sponsor of the show. It's a really important story, how I got to know them. And that is the story of freedom and free markets and capitalism. And PBIs, I call them PBIs, politicians, bureaucrats, and interested parties that were trying to take away the freedom of people to be entrepreneurs. It's a really important story. You can find that at my website. But Hooters Restaurants has five locations: Loveland, Aurora, Lone Tree, Westminster, and Colorado Springs. And they have great specials Monday through Friday for lunch and for dinner. And I also wanted to mention A Climate Conversation, which is a documentary that I'm involved in. It is the brainchild of Walt Johnson. He's a geophysicist, a good friend. He and his wife are friends of mine. And it was on his heart to create a documentary to have just a real conversation about this whole climate issue out there. And you can find more information and see the movie at aclimateconversation.com. And it is just asking questions in the Socratic method about this particular issue. So, again, you can get more information by going to aclimateconversation.com. We get to do all this because of great sponsors, and one of those is Karen Levine.
There are always opportunities in changing markets, and the metro real estate market is no exception. That is why you need to work with seasoned RE/MAX Alliance realtor Karen Levine when you buy your home, sell your home, consider the opportunities of a new build, or explore investment properties. Rising interest rates are spurring creativity, innovation, and opportunity in the real estate and mortgage markets. Kim Munson highly recommends award-winning RE/MAX Realtor Karen Levine. Call Karen Levine today at 303-877-7516 for answers to all your real estate questions. That's 303-877-7516.
Well, Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. Sign up for our weekly email newsletter. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. Thank you to all of you who support us. We are an independent voice, and we search for truth and clarity by looking at these issues through the lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. If something's a good idea, you should not have to force people to do it. We have pre-recorded these shows for the week of Thanksgiving, and really pleased to have on the line with me Dr. Alan Gelzo, who teaches at Princeton University. And before we get back into the conversation, I wanted to mention this, the Center for American Values. It is located right here in Pueblo, Colorado. Pueblo is known as the home of heroes because there are four Medal of Honor recipients that grew up in Pueblo, Colorado. And so the center was founded by Medal of Honor recipient Drew Dix and Brad Padula, who is an award-winning documentary maker, and they realized that we need to do two things: honor our Medal of Honor recipients, and then also instill in ourselves and teach our children these values of America of honor, integrity, and patriotism. So they're putting together some great educational programs as well. You can get more information by going to the Center for American Values, and that website is AmericanValueCenter.org. I'm talking with Dr. Alan Gelzo, and you can find his books at alangelzo.com. That's A-L-L-E-N-G-U-E-L-Z-O.com. And you are working on a new book, correct, Dr. Gelzo?
Yes. Yes, in fact, I'm working on several of them simultaneously.
And what's
which I suppose is it represents a very bad habit on my part. I write books. I should apologize for it. Maybe I should be looking for a 12-step process. Do you think to help me get over this?
I don't think so. The important thing is that you finish them, and you have a record of doing that. So what is your most recent books? What are you writing on?
Well, I will have coming out in February a new book on Lincoln entitled Our Ancient Faith, Lincoln, Democracy, and the American Experiment. Mm. The title is drawn from a speech Lincoln gave in Peoria, Illinois, in October of 1854, where he talks about democracy as our ancient faith. He talks about the Declaration of Independence capturing that ancient faith. So the book is really about what Lincoln had to say on the subject of democracy in its various aspects, like elections, like majority rule, like toleration, like natural law and morality, and the role that all of these play in the making and perpetuation of democracy.
Fascinating. Wow. And so 1854, is that early in his political career, or he'd been in politics for a few years, or what? When was that exactly?
Oh, he'd been in politics for 20 years before that.
Okay.
And it hadn't turned out all that particularly well for him either, because he gets into the state legislature in 1834, and he has four very fulfilling terms in the state legislature. But then he, in the 1840s, runs for the United States House of Representatives. He gets elected, but his term in office is a very disappointing one. He is a Whig. He's a member of the Whig Party. That means, first of all, he's in the minority. But secondly, it means he puts himself in opposition to President James Polk, who at that point was conducting the war in Mexico. And Lincoln has to stand up and criticize Polk, which means that brings down on his head a lot of criticism for not adequately supporting the Mexican War. And he doesn't run for re-election. And he goes home to Illinois. And as he said in an autobiographical sketch that he wrote, he really had given up on politics. He didn't really see much of a future for him after this in politics. And then suddenly in 1854, he gets back on the stage. It's like Abraham Lincoln 2.0. And the reason he does it is because in 1854, Congress passed the so-called Kansas-Nebraska Act, which for the first time in Lincoln's political life made possible the introduction of legalized slavery into the Western territories. And he looked at that and said, if that's going to be a possibility in the Western territories, then that means eventually slavery is going to take over the whole country, including his own home state of Illinois, which at that point was a free state. There was no slavery in Illinois. And this is what propels Lincoln back into the political forefront. He gives the great speech at Peoria in October of 1854, and he talks about our ancient faith. And from that point, Kim, he follows a trajectory upwards, which will, 6 years later, lead him to election as the 16th president of the United States.
Wow. remarkable. And the fact that he grew up in a basically a cabin and read by candlelight, but he read important books. At the end of my show, I say read great books. We have choices to make with what we do each day, each hour, each minute. We have choices. That's a beautiful thing about living in America, that we're free to make those choices. But we need to make choices, I think, that propel us to be our best selves. And the fact that he was just an avid reader. I run into people all the time, and as avid readers of great books, I love conversations with them, Dr. Gelzo.
Well, you would love a conversation with Lincoln then, because this was a man who, all right, on the one hand, he has next to nothing in the way of what you could call formal education. He once estimated that he went to school probably, when you added it all up, to not more than a year's worth of basic education. And yet he has this voracious appetite for reading and for learning. He said his best friend would be the person who would lend him a book. And he read tremendously. Years later, his law partner, William Henry Herndon, actually made up a list of books that Lincoln kept in his law office. You go down that list, Kim, and these are all the major writers of the 19th century. And so we're talking here not just easy marquee names. We're talking about the authors of books on political economy, of books on philosophy, and Lincoln is reading these books on science. He would subscribe to a series of volumes that came out as an annual on new horizons in science in the 1850s, and he ate these things up. There was no subject on which he would not show a curiosity. Someone at one point challenged him. They said, well, we want to describe you in a political biography as someone who has read geometry. And Lincoln's response was, well, I haven't actually read all that much, so let me go out and get the book, and then I will read it. So all you had to do was challenge him. And if there was a book that people were reading or a book that he thought would be important and would expand his horizon, he would not only read it, but he would master the book, because he had a terrific memory. Not perhaps quite what we'd call a photographic memory, but something very close to it. He would read things over once, twice, maybe three times. He'd have them. He could quote them. He could quote huge stretches of Shakespeare, of other English poets of the 18th century. And people were astonished at that, because they would think, well, this man didn't really have much in the way of education. He never went to college. Where did he learn all this? Well, he learned it on his own hook. And as I say, people would be amazed when, given a moment, he would simply launch into a long recitation from Shakespeare.
Well, and my next question is, how did he learn to read? Because out here in Colorado, we just recently had an election, and I had a number of school board candidates on the show, and some of the percentages they were telling me of kids that were proficient in reading was like 30% of the kids are proficient in reading. That means that 70% are not, and we're spending big bucks on this. I said, I want my money back. Every child should be able to read. So how did he learn to read with no formal education?
He probably was taught at home. Because on the other side of the Appalachians, when he was growing up on the western side of the Appalachians, which in those days, that was what people called the West. When we talk about the West today, we're usually talking about, well, Pueblo, Colorado. But back in Lincoln's day, the West was Kentucky. The West was Illinois. Growing up there were no public school systems at all. So people learned, if they were going to learn anything, they were going to learn at home. And their parents were going to teach them how to read. And the neighborhood was going to afford them exposure to books. And it was going to happen in that fashion, because it wasn't until much later in Lincoln's life that you begin to see the organization of public education in the states on the western side of the Appalachians. For Lincoln, it all has to begin at home. It has to begin at his mother's knee. And starting from there, he moves ever relentlessly upwards in his mastery of books. And he has a very healthy respect for education and for reading. And he advises people. Everything that we know in the world can be understood by reading. Reading is what unlocks all the riches of the world. That, for him, was a rule he lived by.
Well, and I really think that, I mean, we have so much that is thrown at us in the society now. And we need to make choices with what we do. And certainly reading for leisure is great. But there's stuff out there now, Dr. Gelzo, that is just junk. How would you address that with your students?
By telling them that there is such a thing as junk in print. And actually, there is a great deal more of that junk on screens. And my advice to them, I can't say that everyone takes it, but my advice to them would be, find the books, not the screens, find the books, because the books are what open up the world to you. Someone who is looking at something on a screen is entirely passive. They can be nothing more than what is on the screen. A book explodes the mind. A book gives you access to realities that you can't touch. It gives you alternative universes you can inhabit. A book will move you to do things that a screen can never even come close to doing. So a book, well, Emily Dickinson, a contemporary of Lincoln's, once wrote a poem about how a book was like a frigate that could take you all around the world, over lands, over seas. And I have myself found anything to fault with that opinion, even though I'm a century and a half beyond both Dickinson and Lincoln. For me, books were what opened up the world. Reading was what opened up all kinds of opportunities, all kinds of vistas. Reading is, in some respects, the ultimate subversive activity. Because what else do tyrants want to do? First off, they want to control what people read. They want to control their media. They want to control their books. They want to burn books if they don't particularly like them. Reading turns people's minds to questioning. That's why in Orwell's 1984, it's books which have to go down the memory hole because books are dangerous. I remember the publication in the 1970s of Alexander Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago. And when the volumes of it came out one by one in English, I would buy them. I was a college student then. And I would buy them. I would take them home. I would set myself up. I almost felt like I should put on a jacket and tie to read them. But you read them, and suddenly the whole fictitious world that had been created by the Soviets and the Soviet Union, all of that fell to pieces. I remember there was a comment that was made by Bernard-Henri Lévy, the French philosopher, a political philosopher, in which he said, Solzhenitsyn simply spoke, and the scales fell from our eyes. And he was talking about reading Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago. It, more even than weapons of war, bombs, economic strategies, it was Solzhenitsyn's book that spelled the end of the Soviet Union. And reading that, for me, that was a liberating experience. And reading has always been a liberating experience, as it was for Lincoln. He once described it in these terms. He was on his inaugural tour from Illinois to Washington. He stopped in Trenton, New Jersey, to speak to the New Jersey Senate. And being there in Trenton, he said, my mind has often revolved back to the scene of the Battle of Trenton and the Revolution. And I've often asked myself what those soldiers in the Revolution, what were they really fighting for? Was it just separation from the mother country? No, they were fighting for something more. They were fighting for an idea, for a principle. And it's an idea and a principle which is common to everyone around the world. And he said, how did I learn about this? I learned about this because as a schoolboy, I read a biography of Washington describing the Battle of Trenton. Now picture this, Kim. Here is a boy way out in Kentucky or Indiana when he's reading this. Here's a boy reading about the Battle of Trenton. And that boy, years later, as President of the United States, is drawing a bright line from a book that he read as a boy to the principles that he would give his life defending as President of the United States. If that doesn't illustrate the importance of reading, I have a hard time imagining what would.
Dr. Gelzo, I just got chills on that. I'm talking with Dr. Alan Gelzo. We get to do these conversations because of great sponsors like Lauren Levy.
If you're 62 or older, a reverse mortgage could be a great tool regarding retirement and estate planning. It is essential to understand the process. Lauren Levy with Polygon Financial Group has nearly 20 years in the mortgage industry and has the experience to answer your questions. Lauren understands that each financial transaction is personal. If you'd like to explore your options on a reverse mortgage, remodel your home, buy a rental property, or move, call Lauren Levy at 303-880-8881. Licensed in 49 states, Kim Monson highly recommends Lauren Levy for all your mortgage needs. Call Lauren at 303-880-8881.
Shooting outside in winter isn't great, but at Franktown Firearms 10-lane, 30-yard indoor range, conditions are always ideal. Franktown's range is ready for handguns, shotguns, rifles up to 50 caliber, and even black powder. Plus, safety gear is always free to use. Since the range connects to their full-service gun store, you can rent a variety of firearms and try before you buy, making sure it's the right fit for you. And with the Franktown membership, you even get after-hours access to the range. Ventilation is top-notch with fresh air constantly circulated, so you can breathe easy while you shoot. Family-owned and operated, Franktown Firearms treats clients with respect, aiming to build your confidence and make this your home on the range. Bring your own gun or try something new today. And KLZ listeners, for a limited time, will receive a free gun rental with any Range Lane purchase. Visit klzradio.com/Franktown to find out why Franktown Firearms is where friends are made.
Welcome back to the Kim Monson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Monson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. Sign up for our weekly email newsletter, and you can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. Thank you to all of you who support us. We are an independent voice on an independent station, and we search for truth and clarity by looking at these issues through the lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. If something's a good idea, you should not have to force people to do it. I did want to mention Janssen Photography. Great entrepreneurs, Glenn and Mary Janssen, have been in business for a long time, creating memories for people, whether or not it is portraits of families or of children, portraits of your senior student, or if you need that great photo for your business or political career, Janssen Photography is the place to go. That website is Janssen, J-A-N-S-S-E-N, photography.com. We've pre-recorded the shows for this week with very special guests. I love it because then we have extra time. And we're talking with Brad Miller, who is my instructor at ipac-edu.org on a great course, Literature as Resistance, ultimately how to resist totalitarianism is the bottom line on that. And it's not too late to sign up. And so you can do that at ipac-edu.org. It's super reasonable, and it is so great. It really gets, just like this interview, getting your brain working. And so that is so important. Brad Miller, this course is fascinating. And the stand that you took as being in the Army and as a colonel and actually resigning right before retirement is such an amazing story, and it's a story that needs to be heard. And how can people find out more about you?
Yeah, thanks for asking that, Kim. So the two easiest places to find me are at my Substack, which is just my name, bradmiller10.substack.com. So again, that's bradmiller10.substack.com. And also, I'm on YouTube, you know, until they kick me off, which may happen at some point. But if you just go to YouTube and you search Brad Miller 10, the videos that I've started making as well will come. Those will come up. So in either place, it's Brad Miller 10 and should come up on YouTube and Substack.
Okay. And again, highly recommend that you check that out and would love to have you join us in our course as well. We've been talking about, we went through the course offerings, the books that we're reading, and the Hegelian dialectic, which basically can create a problem, and then there's the reaction to the problem, and then the solution can many times be already determined, and how that's relating to the Delphi technique. I've learned a lot, so I'm just trying to step back and be a person hearing this for the first time. This is the last segment on this. You know, how do you want to unpack this so that people can understand it? Just it's a little simpler as they're thinking about it.
Yeah, so what I would say is that whether it's with the dialectic or the Delphi technique, both of these are legitimate in their own way. It's just that when networks of powerful people have decided to use either the dialectic view or the use of the Delphi technique to manipulate people, that's, of course, when it becomes problematic. So for us, what that means is important for us to do is realize when our mode of thinking and therefore our actions is being constrained to a very narrow set of viewpoints or a very narrow set of acceptable actions, that's when we may have to ask ourselves, what kind of techniques are being used to manipulate my opinions and or my actions? And then how can I respond to be able to break out of this? So, for example, we were speaking about how the Delphi technique can be used a lot of times in these different types of meetings where some sort of, let's say, some sort of city planning project has already been decided upon. However, the opinions of the public are solicited, and yet when you show up and you're engaging in these discussions, you feel like you're not being heard, or you feel like your opinion is only acceptable as long as it's within a narrow set of topics that you're allowed to address.
So I have an example that I was thinking when I was on city council. We had a little neighborhood library that the people in that my community, we loved. People walked to it, kids walked to it. But the library district and the city planners and the politicians wanted to have a big, big library that more people would, we'd have to drive to it. And, of course, there's all the different arguments around driving, walking, you know, there's all that out there. But I suggested that perhaps we keep this library for this community. And then have the other as well. But they would have none of that. And so they did a listening tour. They solicited from people. And what was amazing is down at the library, our community library, they put up a poster and said, what would you suggest that this building be used for? Because the city said they were going to purchase it from the library district. And what did you want it to be? And on that piece of paper, the number one answer was keep it as a library. But in the report given to us by staff, which was about 50 some pages long, that was not noted until like on, you know, page 45 or something like that. So as I was going through the packet, I'm like, oh, people want to keep this. So I asked that question of staff when they made the presentation, and they said, oh, well, that was not an option. I thought, oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Imagine that. And the way in which a lot of that is done, so when you look at the way in which the Delphi technique is used, perhaps legitimately, as a decision-making or forecasting tool in the corporate world, the way in which it's done is a group of experts are fed different questions to which they respond anonymously. And that's so that they don't bias each other, or that one person's opinion because of their position within the company is not necessarily ranked above the opinions of others. So there may be some legitimate reasons to do that in the corporate world when it's used, you know, in a real way. But a lot of times in this type of situation, a lot of times these questions are fed via these surveys, and you answer again anonymously, and you may be picking a response that a lot of other people are picking as well, and it may be the most popular response, but then they will lead you to believe that your response, which may have been the most popular, was not the most popular, or was an outlier opinion. That's what they may lead you to believe, again, because of the anonymous nature in which the questions are asked and the responses are noted. So there are a lot of these different types of techniques that they can do to kind of, if you have an undesirable opinion, they can kind of corral you in the direction that they want you to go while allowing you to believe that your input is valued.
Brad Miller, this is so antithetical to the way our country is supposed to work, though. I mean, we got to our Declaration, our Constitution, because of real debate, people really kicking tires on the ideas, and real debate, and with a real, I think, a virtuous goal in mind as well. And so this whole thing being used in government, I think it's antithetical to our American idea.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. You know, debate, the reason that we debate, even when debates get heated, is because whichever side you may find yourself on, or even if you don't agree with either side in a particular debate, by debating, we expect better positioned to emerge. In fact, that would actually be a completely legitimate use of the dialectic, because the dialectic can be used legitimately in a debate or in a courtroom trial, where you have two sides that are in opposition to one another, and then through the interplay of those two oppositional sides, the hope is that what emerges, what is the synthesis that emerges? Well, it's the truth. So debates can absolutely be used, and that, you know, when you engage in debate, when you're arguing against someone else's position, you are sharpening each other's understanding, regardless of which position you may hold. So debates are completely legitimate. And when you see whenever you feel like legitimate debate is not being held, you have to ask yourself if you believe that your opinions are being manipulated, or if you believe that your thoughts are being shaped in a previously contrived direction.
Okay, fascinating. We've got probably about 4 minutes left. And I know it's not really enough time, but we've gone through the whole reaction to COVID. And now we're looking at that, hopefully, in the rear view mirror. But what do you think we learned as a country? I mean, I'm seeing people that you know, kind of bought into the whole COVID thing that first time, but now they're like, no. So I think a lot of people are waking up. What do you think, Brad?
I think yes and no. I think some people have woken up and they are not going to go back to sleep. And then I think, sadly, other people have woken up and they're already starting to fall back asleep. And I would urge people, if COVID was what kind of pushed you to wake up, be in that first group. When you wake up now, don't fall back asleep and start making other connections, because you got to ask yourself, the government that is powerful enough to foist COVID and the reaction to COVID upon us, which very much followed the problem reaction solution model, this is not a one and done thing. They are going to continue to try and manipulate us into moving the directions they want society to go. And we've got to be awake to it, and we have to understand the tools and the techniques they use in order to manipulate us.
Well, that's why your voice is so important. And again, where can people find you, Brad Miller?
Yeah, so again, you can find me at my Substack, which again is bradmiller10.substack.com. And then you can also find me on my YouTube. If you just go to YouTube and search bradmiller10, then my videos will come up. And I write quite a bit, just my thoughts about anything and everything. And the same with the videos that I've started to make as well.
And again, you're instructing this great course at ipac-edu.org, where we're going through all of this dystopian literature. It's a course that's going to end up about 21 different meetings, and we're in, gosh, what, number seven, probably close, seven? Are we
yeah,
that far?
That's okay. Right. That's
but you,
right. And we just...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, yeah, the classes are held on Thursday nights via Zoom, but if you miss a class or if you're just joining in now, you can always catch up on the previous recordings.
And absolutely. And we must remain vigilant and sharpen our brains and understand what's going on. And Brad Miller is certainly doing that for many of us. And we'd love to have you all join us. So, Brad Miller, I wish you a very happy Thanksgiving. I thank you for joining us for this very important interview, and we'll have more conversations.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being on, Kim, and happy Thanksgiving to you as well.
And my friends, these are such important conversations. And our quote for the end of the show is from JFK, talking about gratitude. He said, as we express our gratitude, we must never forget that the highest appreciation is not to utter words, but to live by them. So my friends, today, be grateful, read great books, think good thoughts, listen to beautiful music, communicate and listen well, if honestly and authentically, strive for high ideals, and like Superman, stand for truth, justice, and the American way. My friends, you are not alone. God bless you, and God bless America.
Views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker, commentators, hosts, their guests, and callers. They are not necessarily the views and opinions of Crawford Broadcasting or KLZ management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.